Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike, and today's interview is with Eric Amodio. Eric is the CTO at GitKraken, is the creator of GitLens, and previously worked on VS Code at Microsoft. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
I'm excited to have you on the show and learn all about your world. I have had this background in like the Apple development world for many years. But now as I come out more into the broader world, web development, which is actually my background even before Apple development, I've been enjoying really having conversations with folks like yourself who have created and are working on really like big and influential tools in the broader non-Apple ecosystem space, and really excited to learn about that broader kind of code collaboration, working with large teams, running large open source projects.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely grew up in much more of the Microsoft, not Apple space. So, you know, come from different areas. And, you know, like, you know, my first language was really basic and the other things, but like my first thing that really got the aha moment for me was Visual Basic. Like I was in high school or something and just created, there wasn't really open source at that time. I mean, there was, but it wasn't a big thing at that point because, you know, I'm old. But in that point, it was just creating shareware stuff. And so I actually created a little pop notifier at that point when pop was just coming out, and, you know, just little desktop notifications for email, and actually took down the whole college network or school network at that point. You know, it was a lot of fun. And that was just, you know, just getting adoption on something that you put out in creation. That was just the hook for me. You know, just being able to create things.
Let's get into that and let's dig into some of the various fun things that you've built. How about you give us a little bit of a summary before we get into GitKraken and large teams and supporting legacy code bases and all the open source stuff. Like, kind of summarize a bit like your story so far. You know, you can start there in college with building an email client that takes down the network and kind of build up through Microsoft and some of the things that you've done to kind of set the stage.
Yeah. I mean, it was, for me, like I was involved in computers since I was a kid, building them, putting them together. And so I wanted to go to school for hardware. But it's actually like, you know, I had always done some level of programming and playing around with programming, you know, at a really young age. But like, it wasn't as fun for me at that point. Like the hardware stuff I was much more interested in. But like getting the Visual Basic sort of changed the nature of it, whereas like I could create the things I was seeing in my head much more easily and effectively, and then try things really quickly and throw things out there. And this shareware thing really just was really interesting, of just being putting stuff out there, getting other people to use it, and just seeing that adoption, seeing the community come up around some of these things was just, you know, that really solidified the bug for me. And, you know, like I think that's one of the challenges too, like going in school and the rest, is like we start programming from this, you know, the fundamentals. And I'm sure it's changed a lot since I was in school, but like it's a lot of the fundamentals and that sort of stuff, which is good to know, but like it doesn't get you really interested in like the creation. For me, like programming, while I, you know, I love programming, it's really about the creation, you know, it's the expression of creating things and like taking these ideas from nothing, putting them out there, showing them, getting, you know, usage and adoption. And that's sort of guided me throughout.
I feel that 100%. My tool, like you, I started with Basic, but then I got hooked on Borland C++ Builder, which is like kind of, it shares a bunch of spiritual similarities to Visual Basic. It's like, it's a tool in the 90s for making Windows apps that you just like start clicking around and you're like a kid basically making stuff. And, you know, the world is your oyster / you know enough to be dangerous.
And it's fun. Like, and something for me too is like, it's that easy entry, but then start really like pushing the boundaries. I mean, fast forwarding to sort of like, you know, creating GitLens and the rest of it is trying to take a system and just like, you know, VS Code extensions and what VS Code provided at that point in time, and then being able to push the bounds and like bend the system to your will and express that sort of stuff. So like the same thing with, you know, Visual Basic was just like, you know, how can I get it to do the things I want really quickly, you know, get the basics, but then layer on more into that. So I was always interested in learning and keep continuing the system and like, you know, learning how Windows worked underneath the, you know, the Visual Basic, so I can hack the actual HWINs behind it and start writing, you know, to lower layers. You know, for me, it was that creative expression, getting, building things. And a lot of the times, like most the things that I've built are all really about scratching my own itch when it comes down to it. Mm-hmm. It's like, I wanted this tool. So, you know, built sort of Pop Notifier. Like, I was at a company, we used email a lot, and it was just, you know, just Outlook was just very minimal. Outlook didn't have notifications and stuff yet at the early stages. So I built a app that sort of plugged into Outlook to build that. I built a lot of extensions to Visual Studio because I had to live in that environment. So built things for, you know, Visual Studio, and then built command line tools, expand stuff into, you know, anytime I like in diving in and living in tools and stuff, if there's extensibility, I find myself trying to customize it to, you know, how it fits my workflow better and that sort of stuff. And then start offering those tools up, and, you know, GitLens is an extreme expression of that, which grew into something far larger than I would have ever expected.
So I think probably most folks, at least, you know, a lot of our audience is engineering leaders and founders and things. So a lot of folks are going to be familiar with GitLens, considering that it has like ridiculously large install base. But not everybody will have, especially maybe people in the ecosystem or if they're more on the product side of things. So how about you kind of summarize what GitLens kind of is and its success so far?
You know, where it started, you know, the humble beginnings were really just like, you know, I was working on a team, we were adopting Git, and, you know, I was the sort of Git expert and, you know, just trying to get, you know, get people onboarded to help that sort of flow. So, you know, dealing with that sort of pain of like onboarding to Git, because Git is harder, and, you know, it's changed a lot over the years, but it's still not as accessible, and that's why we have our
I typed revert and it didn't revert. I have detached head, this sounds bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the command line is not user friendly.
Yeah,
you know, that's sort of where it started. And then I also, like, at the time just fell in love with VS Code as an editor. You know, I was much more used to Visual Studio. I did not like the experience because, you know, really at that time it was really big, really slow, lots of stuff. So like getting into a much faster Sublime Text and then VS Code was really interesting. So they came out with the extension API, and that's where I started playing with that. And then very quickly it started, you know, it started with just like, well, can I show some Git stuff to make that flow a little bit easier? But then it also really quickly transitioned into what are the things that I do a lot as, you know, like a senior lead dev, of diving into an existing code base. And it was really about, you know, like I was always walking back through history. It was like, how did we get to this point? Like, before I go and make these changes in this big system, how did I get here? Like, am I going to make the same mistakes again? You know, because like this code is, you know, looking at it objectively from the surface, it looks weird. Well, maybe it's weird for a really good reason. And or maybe it's not.
Or maybe it's not.
Right, exactly. And so like just being able to, you know, make that. So like some of the first iterations were just, you know, can I make it easy to just show you the diff of the previous version and keep walking back in history? And then it was, you know, how do I surface that information even easier? And so that's where like the inline blame started coming with, you know, on where your cursor is. So like at any point in time, you can see like how recently this changed and by what, and then give you a little bit more insight on, you know, hopefully there's a reasonable commit message, but it would tell you a little bit more about why that code is at that state and then be able to walk back through there. So that guided a lot of it. And then it, you know, snowballed into, you know, getting used and, you know, just continue building out tooling, and, you know, was my obsession for quite a while.
So you say snowball into getting used, and obviously, you know, it's one of the great joys of building products to have traction and people are using it. But as I understand it, like getting used is like tens of millions of downloads, right? It's not like, oh, a few people using it now. And so that then kind of obviously offers opportunities once you have both the user base and you also have the kind of compounding experience of building a tool that is being used by tens of millions of people and is being used especially perhaps obviously a tool like that is especially useful for large teams that are working on large existing code bases with a lot of curious artifacts that maybe for good reasons or maybe not. And so that led you to GitKraken now. Tell us about how that came together.
Yeah, I mean, GitLens, as it, you know, continued to expand and grow that, GitKraken is a tool, you know, with a similar spirit, right? It's like, you know, trying to make Git and deal with that and, you know, work with your team and manage merge conflicts and make that stuff more accessible and easier to understand. And then, you know, they had a strong focus on visualization. know, and there's some level of visualization that both of us, you know, tried to do. Like they have a, you know, they had a really strong graph visualization. GitLens never had a graph visualization, but that was something that had been asked for from the beginning, but is like, you know, never made it high enough on my, you know, to lose sleep over work to build that out. But there was, you know, other features too, like, you know, interactive rebase. They had a really visual interactive rebase. GitLens had a very visual interactive rebase, and there's a lot of similarities between the two of them. And so we approach things in a lot of similar ways, but, you know, also being in the IDE affords a different use case from someone on the desktop. So, you know, they, you know, approached, we, you know, had lots of conversations on how things could work together, where a bigger picture can go. So yeah, I joined GitKraken 2.5-ish years ago, as, you know, bringing GitLens into that fold and sort of, yeah, became the CTO and then continued to build out our, you know, the much bigger vision of, you know, rather than just purely being a set of Git tools, really moving into collaboration and how teams work together better. And, you know, if we can really focus on changing, you know, how we code, right? Like if we can get collaboration much earlier in the process to share things early, we can sort of get much better outcomes at, you know, at the end.
Yeah, and that's one of the kind of core fundamental things about engineering leadership is like, okay, well, we have this shared goal and we have all these individual engineers that, with their various strengths and contexts and understandings. How do we translate that into one coherent, high-quality code base, given that for any successful product, the code becomes too complicated to be in any one person's brain? We have all these separate, unconnected brains. So how do we manage that?
Context is hard, and yeah, that's you know, one of the challenges of smaller teams, right? Like smaller teams can move very quickly because you can, you know, in general, you know, your products are simpler, and so you can hold more of the code base in your head. And the more you can hold in your head, the easier it is to iterate and see the edges and refactor and change. But yeah, that gets, you know, we need to rely on a lot more tooling to make that happen once things get to a certain size.
Yeah, so I'd love to dig in a little bit into some of the tooling and both like the kind of the state of the art as well as like future directions for that. But something at that point of like bringing GitLens into the fold of GitKraken, which is like already established successful product of its own that has like, you know, business behind it and a business model. Tell me a little bit about like that journey of going from like, okay, we have this open source project and it's popular, but like we'd like to make it sustainable so that, you know, it keeps getting better. And, you know, the famous thing that most software projects need to come up with at some point when they start as a free side experiment. How did that like kind of navigating that go and like, you know, any interesting lessons or surprises from going through that?
That's kind of like a huge challenge in there. It's like, you know, take something that, you know, has a very large user base of a following. You know, we had, you know, I wouldn't say we had a strong open source community. I mean, not like with contributions. I mean, we got some, but it was really around the edges, minor bug fixes and that sort of stuff. But it was a lot, you know, issues and engagement and stuff like that, that we had, a lot. And there was a lot of, obviously, usage of it. And then, yeah, transitioning to bringing that into GitKraken and then trying to layer onto that, it was definitely a challenge for us to figure out. Like one of the things, you know, that we, you know, I wanted to do and GitKraken wanted to do was not damage that in any way, not hamper it, not sort of like, oh, like this is, we're going to turn this into like everything that you're doing, you've got to now pay for. Like we really wanted to, you know, continue the open source and continue building that, but also provide some level of, you know, capabilities on top of that, that, you know, were paid features to continue funding and expanding, you know, what we wanted to build there to continue to invest in the entirety of the product. And some, you know, the challenges there, right, our open source community is challenging it of itself.
What would be challenging? That sounds like a win for everybody. The product is still free. You're adding more functionality. I'm sure everyone was perfectly happy and no one had anything
exactly
to
it
say.
It would be nice. but, you know, I think there's a level of, I don't know, appreciation or just like, you know, an expectation that is a little bit too strong of a through line through our you know, communities of that, you know, everything should be free. And like, you know, everything can't be free. Like, you know, people need to eat and they need to pay bills and all of this sort of stuff. So like, you know, there isn't the free lunch. So like, these things have to happen in some places. And I think one thing that also makes it a little challenging is that when you've got, you know, big companies, you know, Microsoft and Google and others who can, you know, easily afford to have these open source projects that, you know, to the users are completely free.
Sure.
It changes the nature.
VS Code is free. Like, why can't it be free? Microsoft can afford it. Why can't Eric?
You know, VS Code is free. So everything that's part of it should also be free. And that is some level of expectation. It's changing over time. But, you know, Microsoft even sort of has seen that with Copilot. You know, Copilot is not a free product. And so it's a paid extension on VS Code, and their reviews on that are not very good at all for that product.
Interesting.
It's purely on how dare you ask to pay, rather than the merits of the product in and of itself. So that is definitely a challenge. You know, a lesson that I would, you know, that I took away from it is, like, you know, it was much harder than I would have expected it to be. You know, I didn't expect the same level of angst that we got to it, because we were trying to be really thoughtful of how we did it. Like, we literally did not take away a single feature that was free. We only added on, as well as adding a bunch of free features, we added, you know, a set of paid. We thought that this would not be as negatively received. We were wrong. I mean, like, it depends, right? Like, you know, like, right or wrong is hard to judge, because there's always a vocal minority that completely drowns out the majority. So, like, on the majority side, you know, we were fine, because, you know, usage was still continuing to increase dramatically. You know, we've got people, you know, signing on to pay for the new features and that sort of stuff. So from that side, it was fine. But, like, I really also wanted to serve the entire community and, like, you know, not have the you know, some of the negative outcomes from some of that. And so, you know, some of it would have been really to reach out to the community about the plans before they happened. Just been a lot more of, like, throw stuff out there of, like, this is where we're thinking of going. These are some of the things we're thinking about doing, and getting a little bit more engagement. Mm. You know, I can't say that it would have had a significant difference to the plan of what we would ultimately deliver, because, like, I think what we ultimately delivered was the most generous and most, you know, community forward that we could do at that point. But I think it would have helped take the community along that trail and see the thinking behind it and explain the thinking behind it, rather than it just coming up and then trying to explain it later. Like, you know, like, sure, like, these are the reasons why this stuff happened. Like, you know, explain why we're thinking about doing these things before it happens, I think would have been a, you know, something very valuable for us to do.
Yeah. Well, that's to some degree a good lesson, but also there's always a little bit of, a trap, I think, in business, where you're always going to have some type of customer, even free user, or free product isn't exactly a customer, but, like, some kind type of user who is going to be mad at you because the thing that they want or need is not financially viable and is not a sustainable business, and that if you did the thing that they want, you would stop existing. And then they're going to be mad at you because that's a frustrating thing. And, like, you can explain all you want, and, like, some percentage of them will be like, oh, I do see. But, like, there's always a bit of a kind of, you kind of have to time box how much of it as a product owner, as a person building a business, building a product, you have to time box how much you sort of do the right thing and try to do right by people who are sort of just wronged by the universe, by they want a thing that isn't financially sustainable at all. And then kind of, like, you know, to pivot to, okay, how do we make a great thing for everybody who is willing to either pay or be supported by the free version of the paid thing and be kind of part of that ecosystem. So don't be too hard on yourself, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think where it becomes more challenging, right, it's more of a personal thing, right? Like, it's mm-hmm. because it's not like it came from a big project or, you know, with lots of people involved. Like, this is something that I spent literally 5-6 years building purely myself, and, you know, created a lot. And then it's, like, you know, it's just personally hard to get the negativity on, like, oh, it's been destroyed,
yeah,
when it literally has only gotten significantly better without even talking about any sort of account payment, anything, right? Like, those are all sort of cordoned off, and, you know, just the main product. So what you're saying is absolutely true. And that's, you know, things that, like, it's constantly like I have to check of like, oh, here's another negative review. Okay, like I can't let that sort of detract from like all the good that we're doing, the things that we're creating, the tools that are improving workflows and the things that we're really focused on. But, you know, it is the you know, nature of the beast too. It's just like, you know, negativity, you know, eclipses positivity too often. So it's also just, you know, making sure that we keep remembering that.
Yeah, there's kind of a famous dynamic that happens as you get fame or traction or users or scale or whatever, which is that you sort of have this set of, I don't call them coping strategies, but they kind of are coping strategies that leaders use to still maintain empathy and humility in humanity, but not just get completely subsumed by the, even if it's only 0.1% of all people at a certain scale, like if you run Apple and you just, even if 99.999, you have the highest customer sat than ever, like there are literally a million people who hate your guts, right? Even if you're doing the best job, and like obviously Apple has a lot of reasonable things that you can complain, right? But like, whatever, think of the company that is most loved and doing the best, literally the best run company on the entire planet at that scale. It's, you know,
yep.
So, yeah, so it's like, you know, just part of the journey of leveling up, I guess.
Yeah, and so it's definitely a you know, something you learn as you sort of grow there. Like, you know, not having dealt with that before, it was a new experience. And so, like, you know, trying to build those muscles. So yeah, that was definitely learning.
So now GitLens is part of GitKraken, and you've been evolving the tools. I want to dig into that and a bit about what you've been learning and how teams are sort of the state of the art and beyond of tooling for, you know, team collaboration, building software together. But there's one little blip of this part of the story that we skipped over or very, very briefly hand-waved, which is that you worked on Microsoft on VS Code. That's kind of interesting. Like, tell me a little bit about that and like what you learned doing that. That was in the pre-GitKraken sort of era, I guess.
Before GitKraken, after GitLens, and after GitLens was, you know, pretty popular. But yeah, I mean, I had worked with people at Microsoft on different teams through GitLens on, you know, like the live share and getting that exposed through GitLens and, you know, working with that team and launching that sort of thing. And then I became a lot closer to the VS Code team. So there was, a lot of things about joining the VS Code team to expand the Git stuff and the rest of it. I had also I've created other extensions, and I created an extension called Remote Hub, which was basically let you virtually, you know, open a repository that it was hosted on GitHub without having to clone it locally, go and browse and all that sort of stuff. So I created a rough prototype. I could never ship it fully in the marketplace because it used all private and proposed APIs that, you know, extensions can't take advantage of. But, you know, I created that sort of strong proof of concept. So one of the things when I joined, that was one of the things that I wanted to start building out. So, you know, I joined up in Microsoft 4 or 5 years ago, somewhere around there. And then, yeah, started building out the sort of timeline feature in VS Code to start bringing sort of file history and that sort of features, you know, some of the stuff from GitLens, but a version of it to get into, you know, VS Code proper. And then took over the Git extension. And so continued managing and start building out some stuff there. And then one of the big things that I was trying to do was to build out this Remote Hub version, which eventually became, you know, vscode.dev and github.dev. So like, you know, if you go to a GitHub repo and hit dot, you get launched into a VS Code experience. And then you can sort of virtually open files, make edits, commit back, all that sort of stuff. So that was one of the things that I was really thrilled to be able to build. It was actually interesting that, you know, GitKraken had approached me, forget which year it was, but I think it was like 2021 in February. And, you know, I was like, well, I really am not leaving Microsoft until I ship this thing that I fought so strongly to get and do, you know, I really wanted to see it through completion to get it launched. And yeah. And so like I ended up, you know, actually leaving Microsoft and joining GitKraken in October. And we shipped the VS Code and GitHub Dev in September. So I really just wanted to make sure that project that I spent a lot of time and effort and, you know, actually got the Microsoft machine to move and
non-trivial
ship.
Exercise.
So that was a lot of fun. That was a, you know, really interesting project. It was really interesting to see how decisions sway in Microsoft, because there's, you know, false starts of, you know, like started building it. And then we're like, no, we can't build it because it could compete with other things. And then external forces started coming into play, and then it got back on the table. And it was really interesting to get a different glimpse to some of that big company side that the VS Code team is largely insulated from, but I hadn't also experienced before. So it was an interesting learning experience.
Yeah, that is interesting because obviously large companies are sort of infamously, it's more complicated to get things done, to get things shipped. There's more interest, there's more teams, there's more coordination and collaboration and buy-in that's needed. But Microsoft, I think, is a particularly interesting case. And I'm particularly curious when I talk to people who have had some time working at one of the groups there, is because Microsoft is not a, even less so than a lot of companies, Microsoft is not a homogenous organization. Like, you know, even Apple isn't homogenous, even though it's probably one of the more homogenous large orgs. But like, Microsoft is a patchwork of all sorts of different teams with different origins. Like GitHub was an acquisition that has totally different culture, but then of course has been a part of Microsoft for quite some time now, but it's still very different. And then all these different teams all have different business motivations, all these sort of things. And so I hear sometimes very conflicting stories like, oh, I worked on this team at Microsoft, and all of those problems that you hear about, like, they weren't there. Or someone else is like, I worked on this team at Microsoft, and oh, those problems were 20 times worse than you hear, right? And it's like, oh, that's interesting. So it's interesting for you to hear, or to hear you say, at least from the scope that you were on, that the VS Code team was like relatively insulated, or like, I guess, set up for success in the scale of how bogged down any given team could be and still trying to make the world a better place and ship good products that they were set up.
Yeah, I mean, it's mainly like a mini startup, very just purely engineering led. Very different experience from a lot of the other teams. And sitting between, like, you know, I was on the VS Code team, but because we were also doing stuff with GitHub on the GitHub dev and, you know, interfacing with the GitHub teams, there's a lot of interface there. But it was also like we were bringing, as part of that project, was also bringing just VS Code to the web as some of that for Code Spaces. So it was like the Code Spaces team, which was some of GitHub, some of Microsoft, and different teams. And so there's many different dynamics. And then also what came up in that same period of time was Copilot was being incubated. So like I was involved in the very early stages of Copilot and trying to get Copilot into VS Code. So, you know, my hacking skills of bending VS Code of like, you know, displaying different things. And so I created some, you know, prototypes to get, you know, like the inline suggestions before it was actually baked into the product and turned into real APIs to support it. So doing some hacking around that sort of stuff to help that team. So it was, that was a really interesting experience of seeing Copilot start from something in the beginning was really laughably unusable to very, very quickly. I mean, in a few short weeks become so much better every iteration. It was like unreal of, you know, how quickly that changed.
Did it give you that feeling? This is like some time ago now, like you were some of the first people in the world to see this thing that's probably changing our entire industry forever in deeply fundamental ways. Was it like in those weeks as it was starting to become like so much better and really start to actually kind of work and you could see the shine, like, did it feel kind of epic? Like, did it feel like, oh, wow, like this is a big deal?
Yeah, because I mean, like, to be honest, like I had, you know, I had been playing with autocomplete AI stuff before that. You know, I had, you know, talked to Tab9. I had worked, you know, a little bit closely with that Tab9 team. And then they, you know, I used the Tab9 product, which was sort of really the pioneers of getting that sort of richer autocomplete. But they was a very limited set. And Copilot was trying to be like, can we autocomplete bigger? And, you know, like in the first version, you know, the first few versions that I was playing with is like, I can't use it. Like, it's so wrong so often. And like, like, this is not even remotely close to what Tab9 is doing. And then, you know, like, it was like a matter of a month where it was like, okay, I'm not using Tab9 anymore. And it was just like, wow, this just, it was just shocking of where it went from just really just not good to this is really like getting what I'm thinking. And like it went, you know, because a lot of the Tab9 stuff was originally like a couple words at most at that point. And then this would sort of do much more full statements. And then they were trying to do multi-statements. The multi-statement stuff never panned out. I mean, like at that point in time.
Obviously it panned out
quite well, but like there it was, you know, just getting that line, but it became amazing. It was just kind of insane. And, you know, it was just like any of those sort of things, it was scary good, but also scary for like, because it, you know, things that it could generate, you know, a lot of times it, you know, it may look reasonably good. Like it like got the intent really well, but like, hey, that variable doesn't actually exist. Yeah, it makes sense that it could, but it doesn't. And like that thing doesn't exist. And, you know, and that, you know, that's changed a lot over the, you know, over the years to make that a lot better. But that was sort of like, you know, worrying, like, you know, as someone who understands the code base and understands what they're working on, that's easy to pick out. And like in type checking also makes that easier. But if you're, you know, don't understand that, it becomes much more problematic. And that's just a challenge with AI in general, right? Like,
absolutely.
If you understand the areas, it's a really valuable tool. But if you don't, it's a valuable scaffolding tool, but you don't know if it's right or not. And it becomes hard to judge. And it's also like, you know, human nature to defer to the computer as being the expert if you don't know better.
Yes.
And that also is just, you know, it's a challenge with these sort of tools as we continue to evolve them before they really are the expert. And we're getting closer.
Yeah. And you have a really good perspective on this because, you know, you having worked on VS Code and having worked on Copilot and having worked on GitLens and now having worked on GitKraken, which are all these tools in and around this question of, okay, we have a large code base. We want to try and reason about it. We want to try to be iterating it. We have humans and computers and how can they work together to build better software faster, more effectively. You have so much context on this question that kind of all of us are asking. I mean, some people feel like they know the answer, but I think anyone reasonable has some uncertainty about how is the next 5 years and how is the next 10 years and honestly, how is the next 18 months going to track in our relationship with these language model tools that are helping us build software and how are they changing the nature of software engineering? And think questions as simple as the one that you were sort of poking at there, which is the relative contribution and relationship in between senior engineers and junior engineers. So what are kind of some of the big thoughts? Like what's been, I don't want to say keeping you up at night. I don't want to tell everyone that you're not sleeping well, but sometimes I do find myself thinking about these things. But like what's been kind of engaging your mind as you see these things change and as you're like really involved in kind of helping it change with building some of these tools?
It's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, nobody really knows, right? And like, you know, when it comes down to it is like, I think we are going to be, you know, just like I was in those, that month that it took Copilot to just take an enormous leap. I think it's the same sort of thing. I think we're going to be really surprised and shocked continually in these increments as this, you know, the state of the art just keeps expanding because it's continually, like since it came out, the shocks have been still, you know, quite amazing, you know, where I think it's, you know, I think one of the biggest, you know, like a lot of things, I think some of the challenges are the near term, right? Like, you know, as this technology gets more adopted, you know, it's going to change the nature of like what it is to be, you know, a good dev. Right now, If you're you know, a senior dev or that sort of thing, these are invaluable tools to be more productive. Like they just help you take the things in your head. It's easy to get them out there faster. It's easy to vet them. It's like, you know,
if it's a little bit wrong, you can tell.
Yeah, like being an editor is easier than writing. And so like, you know, if you can just go and like get some of the rote stuff out and easily correct it and that sort of stuff, it's like an enormous boost. It's a pretty good boost for even just learning something you're not familiar with, but you got to do a lot more vetting, right? Because you're unfamiliar. Like, is this the right way of doing it? What are the edges there? You know, my view is like over time, we're going to get to the point of, you know, I don't know how far out it's going to be, but like, you know, AI will ultimately become sort of a new compiler. Right. It's like it's going to just level up the layer of abstraction that we write to, you know, like we don't write assembly anymore. You know, and lots of companies don't write, you know, C in other lower level languages anymore. And, you know, we keep moving up this higher level of abstraction. So it's like, can we, you know, express, you know, what we're trying to do at a higher level and still get this stuff out? So like it's going to come down to, you know, these systems are going to have to be a lot more testable and just validating this sort of output and that sort of thing. And you'd be able to, you know, self-maintain some of this. And so I think, you know, it'd be interesting as, you know, my thoughts for getting further is like, as we get to that, you know, you're just building to a higher level abstraction. It's like, it becomes just like, we don't care necessarily. I mean, like, when I say we don't care, I mean, we do still do it in certain levels, right? Like, but generally, like if I'm writing a project for the web, like I don't care what assembly actually gets, you know, I don't care what instruction set actually gets generated to run that on that chip. You know, that's just an implementation detail for having that. And so we don't necessarily care about the code generation. We just trust that that compiler, that transform is going to make that happen. And there's so many of those layers in our systems already of that transformation all the way down to the actual hardware running it, which has many translation layers inside it to run. And so, like, you know, I think we'll get to the point of just not necessarily caring about this code because it'll be easy to generate and it'll be easy to change. It's like, you know, oh, like, you know, generate this thing that's going to go do that. Oh no, that this input is different, change this output. The code's going to get generated now to do that. And like, you're going to be tweaking more spec level and test level, you know, sort of in and out to go and validate and do that. So, you know, like managing large code bases and managing large amounts of code may not be something that we worry that much about, but you know, that's down the line.
Yeah, well, I mean, but there's a famous thing where the less code you have, the more you can reason about, the more you can keep it in your head, is what you're talking about. So obviously, if we can iterate to a path where LLMs and AI is reducing the need for us to manually maintain larger and larger code bases, then that should in various ways be a big win. Have you seen any, and this is like a naive question, but have you seen any like efforts or projects where people are defining sort of like LLM-powered or AI-powered, like higher-level languages or formats that are sort of built with this in mind? This is also new. It's really only the last like year or two that you could even imagine building something like that. But have you seen any experiments like that yet?
Not per se. I mean, like, I think there are some that are like, you know, taking, you know, a quote-unquote no-code platform and trying to do the generation of, you know, from blocks, you know, higher level blocks to actually going and running it. So there are some of those examples. And then there's, you know, like some of them, even like the Vercel, the, I think it's V0, right? Just taking a mock UI and generating the code to go and do that. And you can change the UI and generate new code and like really iterate on that quickly. So, I mean, those are sort of like starting there, but, and I, you know, there was some TypeScript or type, you know, started by this TypeScript team. There's another thing about like strongly typed inputs and getting that same outputs there and sort of to iterate on some of the structures and be able to validate some of the ins and outs of the models. I can't remember the name of the projects. It's escaping me right now. But I haven't seen a ton of that, but, you know, more from the UI side rather than the actual, you know, the deeper level code of, you know, understanding the systems and that sort of stuff.
It's interesting that you mentioned strongly typed without getting into like a deep rat hole on like programming language nerdery, but it's interesting that you mentioned strong typing because there's been this huge trend over the last like decade where in programming languages where it's like, you know, strongly typed languages, like we were talking about C++ before or whatever, it's like, oh, of course, that's the way that, you know, computers are written. And if you're writing within a language like BASIC that doesn't have strong typing, then it's like, oh, well, that's just a toy for people to learn like you and I when we were kids. And then strong typing kind of became way less in favor as like the biggest applications are being written in JavaScript and Ruby and PHP. And then now in 2024, TypeScript is like on the rise and we have Rust and we have a kind of a pendulum moving towards, not obviously everybody's writing in type languages. Not everything is as like rigorous as, you know, Haskell or even Swift in its strictness about types. But that annotation happens to be in more favor or at least fashion. But I think personally that there's it has a bunch of utility, there's a good reasons why it's become more popular. It's becoming more popular at a time where we're getting this huge boon of language models that can reason about your code better if it has annotations like that. And so one of the things that I like as a thought experiment to ask folks like yourself that thinks about this stuff is, if you had to bet, would you bet that we, over the next 5 or so years, as we are doing more and more LLM-assisted software development, that there is a further move to more annotated code because it helps the models reason about it? Or the kind of other argument that I've heard people make is that actually there'll be a pendulum back away from type annotation manually, because the LLMs will be so smart that they can infer the types and they can reason about the software in the loosely untyped software in a more rigorous way, in a way that makes it having the types actually in the code redundant.
I'll take the sort of middle of the road. I think you'll actually get both.
Boo.
but I think it will be a pendulum over time. So like, I think in the near term, you're going to get a lot more of the strongly typed to keep the rails on that sort of thing so that you can validate this stuff. And I think you're going to even go further with that. But I think as it gets further along, where the abstraction for you're less writing code and more writing, you know, a spec or sort of like explaining the systems, then I think it becomes looser again, right? Because it becomes harder to get English to be strongly typed. But, you know, there still may be strong guides on like the blocks and the building and the structures of like how that spec is. That would be the strong typing of that sort of model. But, you know, it may not feel the same as like a typing. You know, annotations is more of a structural setup. So I think we'll get more, but then it'll also go to less.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I'm jokingly blaming you, but I think it's actually a pretty sound argument. And I could see, and I think you're sort of saying this, but maybe at least you're saying a little implicitly, I could see it being like assembly, and that there's this, continues to be this layer, like we don't write assembly, but the assembly still exists, right? And you could imagine that whatever programming languages that are the sort of 5 and 10 year evolution of what we're using to specify our programs, increasingly we're not, as human beings, interacting with those programming languages very much, and which would free the language design to be ridiculous. Like you could imagine it being really annoyingly typed. You could imagine it being quite difficult to read it, right? Obviously, there'll be people like you and I that are maybe too old by then to be like, no, you should be able to read code, and like, you can't just let that trust the LLM. Yep. But then you can imagine a new generation of people who are like, no, but this code that it writes is so much more efficient / easier to test, easier to whatever. And then like, you can read it, like you just kind of gotta squint at it and you can figure out what it means. But I'm spending all my time just writing natural language that it's using to create that code anyway. So like, why do I care that it's really obtuse?
Exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know if I look forward to that future, but I'm fascinated by, I guess by then, I'm not really writing much code myself anymore these days, so I don't have to worry too much about being the dinosaur that can't read that code.
But it's a cycle that we've been going through since the beginning, right? Like it's the same, you know, like writing to the low level, writing to the registers on the hardware that you're married to, and then, you know, coming up to like the, you know, assembly kind of like get, you know, a little bit layer of insulation, and then coming, you know, to the next layer and keep going up. So, I mean, it is a pattern, and just like anything, right? It's like, it's a generation thing too. It's like what you're used to doing is like, oh, we shouldn't go down that. Like that's that code is really important. And, you know, and sometimes, right, like, you know, like, at some level, like the assembly that, you know, the V8 engine generates to, you know, take that JavaScript code to run it, like, is important because like how optimized that is. But then even that, you know, like there's been a bunch of different, like, you know, LLM stuff of trying to do optimizations on, you know, looking at the running code and trying to generate more efficient code to run on that hardware. Is like, you can get even further down. You know, go from not only translating your written stuff, but like all the way through the stack of like just getting more optimizations, because you can, you know, see even chip layout, right? Like how the chips execute, how they're even laid out. It has could have an enormous impact on, you know, handling stuff that is hard for humans to keep in their brain. Like we already can't. Like these are enormous things. So yeah, it's just really interesting where the opportunities.
I look forward to slash dread the point where we're getting to LLMs proposing code that like just doesn't make any logical sense at all. And it's like inherently, it's like a syntax error or whatever when a human reads it. But it's like, oh, but actually that tricks the compiler into doing something that's undocumented functionality that's like, but it makes it 20% faster or has some great outcome. And like,
yeah, the way the, you know, electricity flows through these lines and it changes this.
Yeah,
and
exactly. Yeah, and that happens to be totally reliable, will cost all CPUs for some reason that manufacturing at TSMC or something like that. Okay, so I love that. And before we run out of time, though, I wanted to just kind of poke into a little bit the work that you're doing, kind of build the full circle. So, you know, GitLens became part of GitKraken. We talked about a bunch of sort of topics around broadly teams collaborating, building tools, including LLMs, but also other kinds of tools like the ones that you've been building so far on helping teams execute and being able to be more and more effective as your code base scales and ages, basically. What are some of the, or maybe anything that you're particularly excited about in terms of work that you've been doing or things that you've been seeing in terms of stuff that makes a really big impact on that, either stuff that you've shipped recently and that you're finding is being really effective, or anything that you're working on that you're excited about?
The things that we're really focused on is obviously our Git roots and sort of understanding that and dealing with that sort of stuff is in continuing to expand that. But layering on top of that, getting the teams to work more effective together and just collaboration more. And, you know, like even if you consider LLM starting to write more of the code and the rest of it, like still collaboration earlier in the process on the ideas on, you know, where we're trying to go and just getting that sort of flushed out, you know, is going to continue to be something that's going to give you outsized effects when you get to the outcome. So we're trying to do things in the beginning to be able to make it easier to share code. So, you know, we shipped a feature recently called Cloud Patches. It's really in its infancy. It's the building blocks for us to build a lot of other workflows on top of. But the sort of the intent is to just be able to take something that you've written that doesn't even have to be committed, doesn't have to compile, doesn't have to do anything, and share it quickly to somebody else to get some feedback, get some direction. Mm. I mean, it could be pseudocode that you can provide to somebody else to like, here's the scaffold of the places you think you should go. You know, I think we should go on this, send it off and be able to make it really easy to apply that. We're applying that same sort of thing in the near future to pull requests and trying to get that to change the nature of how you review code and effectively just understand that. We're also focused on, you know, helping developers focus. Like, you know, there's always a bunch of tasks to juggle around. And so we're trying to do is like how we can optimize, you know, getting you like almost poking you for the things that you really should just get done. They're small things, they're team enablers, they're blocking your team, those sort of things, and trying to optimize you to get those things done or provide better signals to your team of like, you know, hey, that review you assigned to me, I'm not the right one, or I can't do it, I'm on vacation, or like, you know, I'm too bogged down, making that a lot easier and like all in the flow to work together. And so we're spending, you know, a bunch of time on that. You know, as we start thinking about collaboration, you know, one thing that I'm thinking, you know, more about, but we don't have any, you know, concrete plans yet of like how we're necessarily attacking the problem. But as LLMs come more into this, you know, we're almost going, I feel, almost take a bit of a step back from collaboration, because, you know, in a lot of cases, I don't have to ask a teammate about that code. I can say like, you know, ask the LLM, where do we do this in this project? Mm. Where does this happen? And the tools are getting so much better at answering those questions. The challenge right now is they're not always right, which adds a whole nother layer of, can you trust it? Which is, you know, we'll eventually get over that, but like that is a challenge now. But like as this evolves, right, and you can actually trust it, like I have a sort of, you know, Copilot is the perfect word, right? It's like I have this thing I can type in at any hour, any day, ask it any question with zero judgment. I could ask it 100 questions, you know, right away, and I can get a bunch of answers that I would normally have to go to other team members, other teammates to go and answer that sort of stuff. So there'll be some level of this collaboration, which is, you know, how do we build the tools that are not necessarily just dev to dev? They're dev, you know, dev to AI as well as that. And then, you know, like even if you start with an, you know, collaborative with an AI, how can you get to take it, bring somebody else into that conversation as well, and sort of like, you know, still enhance the, you know, AI experience, but, you know, continue through that.
Well, I'm very excited for this future. It seems like you're thinking about a lot of high value things. And obviously, LLMs are here to help us, but it's not just about that. And the other people on our team, there's a lot of opportunities for software to make us a lot more effective. So excited to see how that all comes together. Thank you so much for being on the show. Where can people go to find more out about you and the work that you're doing?
I mean, you know, so we, you know, gitkraken.com, you know, has that, our repos on GitHub. So, you know, /gitkraken and the, you know, VS Code GitLens, you know, our CLI is on there, our, you know, newly open source browser extensions on there. So there's communities around that, GitHub discussions. You can find me, I'm at EMAudio on Twitter. I don't post a ton, but, you know, definitely still consuming. We also have a, you know, I run a VS Code Slack community, so you can find that from the VS Code side. And then we have a Slack community for Gitkraken as well.
Awesome. Well, thanks for being on the show. It's Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steamblock Software. If you're a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, then get in touch with Steamclock. That's it for today. You can give us feedback, follow us on social media, or rate the show by going to itshipped.fm/contact. Until next time, keep shipping.